Good morning, diners and travelers. You're listening to On the Menu with Ann and Peter Haig.
And what is it they say in the old Alka-Seltzer commercial? Plop, plop, fizz, fizz. Oh, what a relief it is. Oh, what a relief it is for On the Menu to be back on the air again after our unmitigated disaster. Those of you who have been following know we've put out several programs during the time that we've been struggling to build back up again, but here we are regularly with a Sunday show, and we're so glad that you're still with us, and we look forward to working with you and having you listen in the weeks ahead. And hopefully the technical whiz-bang guys now understand about backups and will make sure that we don't have a recurrence of this problem. And this is not to moan about it, except that it turns out it's caused a fairly large amount of work for both of us, and especially yours truly. But anyway, back to today's show. Today's show is about a group of rather fascinating ingredients, sweet and savory, from the sea, from the land, all kinds of different places, but brought together because they're all in their own way fascinating stories that will allow you to add some unique flavors and some unique tastes into your diet. And first up, one of Anne's favorite guys, Rocco. And what's Rocco's middle name is Boss Hog. And perhaps by that you can understand that this man is obsessed with bacon, and his company's called Bacon Freak.
We're talking to Rocco Loosebrock. Oh, I missed out the middle name, Rocco. Welcome. Tell us what your middle name is. What are you called?
I'm called Rocco.
No, I mean, didn't you tell me something else?
Oh, Rocco Boss Hog Loosebrock.
Boss Hog.
But it doesn't say that on his birth certificate.
No.
No, yeah.
Well, anyhow, but Rocco is the owner and proprietor of BaconFreak.com, which gives you some idea, but only part of an idea of what his business is. We're just going to call on you, Rocco, to just lay it out. You're involved with everything. You said you could encapsulate it in a brief description.
Well, thank you, Ann. Thanks for having me on the program. Basically, Ann and Peter, we are a gourmet food company, and we have a whole variety of different food-related products. Now, the product that we're here to talk to today is about bacon. And basically, what our core business is that we deliver bacon in a box to someone's door. And we always say, what meat-eating carnivore wouldn't get excited about a box of bacon delivered to their door?
Yes. I mean, you do, like, clubs, too.
Right. And basically, the club concept that we offer is an individual comes to our website, and they go, you know, I'd like to buy some bacon for my dad or my brother or, you know, a favorite person in their life. But they don't really know which ones to buy. So they come to us and they buy a term, let's say 2, 3, 6 months, whatever they want. And then we'll send them a variety of different bacon. So this way the recipient can kind of determine which ones they like and then know which ones to order in the future.
So now how many kinds do you have?
Of bacon, we have 16 different flavors of bacon currently. Everything from additional hickory smoke, maple, pepper. I mean, we offer some really neat flavors like sun-dried tomato.
Wow, that's interesting.
Yeah, it's really good. Oh. Cajun, honey barbecue, just a whole different variety of really neat, unique flavor profiles that are really good with cooking.
And bacon jerky.
Yeah, bacon jerky was an interesting story because what happens is package the bacon in retail packages, and they sometimes get damaged, right?
Yeah.
And so all we can do is donate them to, like, the local pantry. We're not able to sell them at that point. So I started experimenting with the bacon and said, I wonder if I can make bacon into something like beef jerky. Well, I solicited the help of several individuals, and we made that happen, and we're the first company ever to come up with bacon jerky. And it's just been a unique product that people kind of, you know, they go, I don't know if I'm going to like it or hate it, but I have to try it.
Yes. Well, I liked it.
It disappeared. The small quantity that you sent disappeared very fast.
Sure.
Now, yeah, we hear that quite a bit. You know, people continue to come back and they go, okay, well, how about this flavor? In fact, we started off with just 3 flavors, and within 5 months we have several new flavors, including maple. And
I think that's what we had, didn't we?
I don't remember. Anyway,
it was maple.
There's a fundamental question here. We're prepared to accept that you're a boss hog because we're kind of nice people, but what made you such a bacon expert?
It was kind of a passion that was born on a business trip. I would travel, back when I was a business banking consultant, I would travel around different parts of the country, and I would visit the South a lot. When I say the South, the southeastern United States, where bacon kind of really, that's kind of where, like, the mothership of where bacon really, that's where its roots are in this country. And ordering a breakfast, and I asked the lady, I said, God, the bacon on my, you know, sandwich is just huge. I mean, big, huge, thick pieces of bacon. I'd never seen anything like that being out here from California. And I asked the gal, I said, well, what is this bacon? And she's like, and she responded, and I'll never forget it. She says, you're not from around here, are you? Yeah. And I'm like, no, I'm a city slicker.
Oh, that's funny.
Well, basically, I had to go back and I talked to the chef at this little diner, asked him a bunch of questions, bought some of the bacon from him there, and then came home and started doing some research as well as cooking it for friends and family. So we're used to bacon that you sell at the grocery store, and that's not how bacon used to be made. Bacon used to be made in an entirely different process. And once refrigeration was invented, they started making bacon really cheap and inexpensively.
Well, you've seen the Wendy's ad, I'm sure.
Yeah, right, the Baconator and Vegetarian and all those neat things.
No, I mean the one that said, when did bacon become a garnish or a, what was it? What was the other one? I can't remember now.
It's not good if you can't remember.
Well, you know, there were three different people and with the pathetic-looking strips of skinny, stringy bacon.
Right.
And different situations. And then they say, come to Wendy's for real bacon.
Real bacon, okay, as opposed to fake bacon.
Yeah.
Wasn't Jimmy Villas we had on the program? He wrote an entire cookbook about bacon.
Yeah, well.
And he totally insulted the store-bought supermarket variety, which where sort of white foamy stuff comes out of the comes out of the fatty part when you cook it.
Yeah, that's like the old sizzling stuff. In fact, I'm glad to hear that because I actually didn't know that about him, and I just wrote a story about him the other day on our blog recommending one of his recipes for our readers to cook for Father's Day.
Oh, no, he has a whole book on bacon.
Well, I knew about the book. I just didn't know about that you guys had interviewed him, and he had that particular thing to say. So that's great to hear.
Yeah,
oh,
well,
yes. I think he writes about it in the book, but he said it on the air, too. And you can see the difference. You know what the most amazing thing about your bacon? One of the most irritating things about bacon is the way it curls up.
Right.
When you put it in the pan and you can't get it to lie down. If you're really primitive, you have one of those metal sheet things that you put in your frying pan to flatten the bacon.
Right.
Here's what I've observed with your bacon. It's so beautifully balanced. Cook it on one side. Sure, it curls up a little bit. When you turn it over, it curls back the other way and becomes flat.
Right.
I don't know if you ever noticed that. I mean, I'm something of a bacon aficionado.
Yeah, yeah.
It's the first time that I've had bacon that is self-correcting in terms of the way it lies in the pan. I think it must have to do with the fact that the marbling of the fat is just right.
Well, that's a combination of that fact that you just mentioned. And do you know what the other reason that allows that to happen?
No, go ahead.
The first premise is that the bacon is dry cured, okay? And it was prepared actually the way that the Romans invented and decided how bacon should be cured and prepared. Okay, so this process was invented 2,000 years ago. It's in the last 50 years that it got changed. By the Americans, I should say.
Okay. I see.
And so basically what we're doing now is we're taking the bacon, we're salting it and smoking it, and that salting process is what extracts the water. So before we put that bacon in your package, in that little retail package, we're extracting 90% of the water. Now here's an interesting thing that we say about our bacon. We say our bacon is the kind of bacon that is the only bacon that you can fry naked. And the reason why that is, Ann and Peter, is by extracting that water, it allows the bacon to be balanced and it doesn't shrink up and curl up. Store-bought bacon traditionally has 60% water.
Yeah.
That's why when you cook a pound, you're left with, like, you know, a bookmark.
Yeah.
You got
exactly.
It. Well, I'm glad now that I understand why. I mean, what I understood because I observed it.
Yeah.
And
the why is very
interesting.
But he's not the only one who's... Now, I do know that I just read an article referring to our culinary... current culinary trend as involving the altar for pigs. But I figure that the bacon relates to that a little bit. But I've been reading more and more stuff. People are absolutely nuts about bacon. Could you explain that? I received two books in 1 year on the history of bacon. Two books.
Yeah, it's interesting. Bacon certainly, you know, a lot of people have been referring to it as bacon mania. And they're wondering if bacon is going to jump the shark, as they say, one of these days. But
I mean, what is jump the shark? I
don't know. It's when it's no longer popular and it's going to go from, right now bacon is found in all kinds of things from desserts to
ice
garnishes
cream,
and
bacon
drinks.
Ice cream and drinks.
Right.
Yeah, smoked
right.
bacon martinis.
Right, exactly. And there's even a new bacon vodka out and we have bacon chocolates out. And so when they say it's jump the shark, it's going to leave that scene and then just go back to being on the breakfast table.
Uh-huh.
But here's the bottom line truth. And I work with a lot of cookbook authors who say that, no, bacon is here to stay because bacon in moderation and prepared the right way can make any meal taste just that much better. And, it, you know, a lot of people think, well, bacon's bad for you. Well, we just had a cookbook chef, Holly Clay, who showed us how to use, you know, bacon with salmon and bacon with broccoli. And she said, you know, hey, put an ounce or two of that into the recipe, and it's going to totally change the taste of that meal and just make it that much more enjoyable.
Oh, I'm sure it would do a lot to boost broccoli.
Yeah, no, I have a number of recipes that I use to make essentially stews and braises and chili and that kind of thing. And there's absolutely no question that starting out with bacon grease brings with it a smoky flavor and the salt you want without you having to add any.
Right.
That there isn't an equal product except if it's ham pieces, which are essentially the same thing. Which essentially are the same thing anyway. They're just
the same animal, right?
They're a little bit more. Well, they're a little more difficult to handle than nice organized strips of bacon.
Yeah, we absolutely agree. I mean, I'm not personally a chef, but whenever I cook, if I can use bacon and just a small piece, you know, one piece can totally change the way a meal tastes. And it just because you get that, you know, if you use an apple cinnamon bacon, you not only do you get the savory, but you're going to get the sweet with it, you know.
So you're enticing me. Now, I didn't know there were all these. I looked at your site, but,
oh, yeah.
But I didn't realize there were so many different.
Let me ask you a really tough question about bacon.
Sure.
When you buy bacon in my native land, you get what's called long back. You get the whole piece.
In England,
you get the piece with the Canadian bacon end, and then you get what's laughingly
streaky.
Referred to as streaky, which is the rest. Now, how come this practice of cutting off the meatiest part of the bacon and calling it something else and selling it for three or four times the price? Where did that come from?
I don't know, but every time I hear those words like back bacon and fat back and all that, it kind of doesn't sound appealing to me. So I've just kind of stayed away from that. So I would say I'm not an expert in those areas.
Okay. I mean, it's called long back because that's exactly what it is. It's the,
right.
It's the whole piece, including the piece that would be sold here as Canadian bacon, which is leaner for those people who care about having lean bacon. Now, I don't care to have lean bacon. That's not why I eat bacon.
Right.
Because it's fatty. I think everybody else does, too.
Yeah, well, you know, you're talking to somebody, by the way, Rocco, who is nuts over lardo. And, oh, I meant to tell you, Rabbit, Ruth Reichel just tweeted something about having a sea urchin with topped with lardo.
Oh, that sounds fair. I want some right now. Now
that's what everybody says.
Now, listeners, what you don't know, but I'm about to tell you, is that when we were in Lucca, Italy, which is the world capital of lardo,
and which is the back, not the belly.
Not only did Anne tuck into slices of lardo, she ate every single bite. So maybe this is a new product direction for you, Rocco.
Lardo. Okay, we'll look into that.
See, I believe it's the fat back as opposed to the pork belly.
I think it is. Yes.
And I mean, of course, on England is just on every menu you have pork belly. I mean, you have that pretty much in New York too, but not like England. It's London is crazed over that.
Right. Well, there's a variety of different ways to cut bacon. Like we offer a cottage bacon, which is kind of the pork shoulder. What I found that's also interesting as we've gotten more creative in preparing bacon, like for example, we offer a beef brisket that's smoked and cured just like traditional bacon. So you
wow.
have beef that has the same exact flavor as traditional bacon. So I guess what I'm trying to say is you can do a lot of neat things if you're willing to experiment. In fact, On a side note, you know, as you know, there's a lot of Jewish folks who talk to me and they go, man, can you make kosher bacon? You know, and it doesn't work. Well, what happened is we experimented with the beef bacon, and now we're experimenting with lamb, and we're taking that lamb.
Lamb bacon's big.
Well, you know, it's interesting, and we're experimenting with it because we're taking that same cut because the lamb has the same pieces, let's say,
yeah,
as the pig.
Structure, right.
And you can take that, if you smoke it and cure it, it's certainly going to have the same flavor.
Yeah, I've seen it on menus. We have it somewhere.
Right. Jewish restaurants that will have it, typically.
Now, let me give you a hint.
Italian restaurants.
Let me give you a hint. Mario Batali, you know, right?
I'm sorry?
Mario Batali, you know Mario?
The chef.
Mario the chef.
Okay.
Malta Mario.
Well, his father is a retired, I think he's a retired aerospace industry worker who lives in Seattle. And he makes a variety of charcuterie, including a lamb prosciutto, and it would be worth your while surreptitiously, I think, to buy some and reverse engineer it in your mind and say, now what is he putting in it that makes it taste so fabulous?
Right.
And I never suggested that on the air, so there. Let's conclude.
Well, let's give a website so that people who are listening can find you and order a different bacon for every month of the year or whatever else you're offering on your website?
Yeah, you can find us on the web at baconfreak.com, or you can always call us up and ask any question at 877, that's toll free, 877-21-BACON.
Sounds great. I'm ready to move in. I mean, you've talked me into it all.
Hey, thank you so much for joining us today. Welcome to On the Menu, and we're so glad we had a chance to talk to you today.
Oh, thank you, Anna Peter.
Keep in touch, Rocco.
Oh, we will.
Okay, bye-bye. Oh, that was interesting. And now it's time to take a break.
Podcasting services for On the Menu Radio are provided by ASP Station, www.aspstation.net.
Welcome back. You're listening to On the Menu. Email us please, onthemenu@onthemenuradio.com. And you can contact us also on our blog spot and on Facebook and on Twitter. Just go to our new, in-progress being designed homepage website and click on one of those tabs, and there you have it. Moving right along, we're moving again with ingredients. Here's another ingredient that's old but has a new interest. It's been newly mass-produced, and it's a rather startling ingredient called black garlic, and the man who's mass-produced it calls us not once but twice from Korea, which put him in the middle of the night.
Yeah, and to prove that we also go far and near halfway there, a very nice young man, semi-retired chef, who's now a house husband in Hawaii, who didn't have enough to do, so he decided he'd start making smoked salt.
Both
of those together in this segment of the program.
Recently in America, we've been very upset about what might be coming to the United States from Korea, especially from North Korea, in the form of flying objects. But On the Menu, of course, has a much nicer product from Korea that we're going to talk about this afternoon. And the wonderful part about it is that Scott
Kim,
who launched a mass production of this substance, which he's going to talk to you about, he's actually calling us right now all the way from Korea. Welcome to On the Menu, Scott.
Thank you very much for calling.
Let's start at the basics. This black garlic is really fermented, right? Can you describe the process?
Yes. We create a patent process machine that creates a black garlic. So simply, we only use one ingredient, raw garlic. What we do is we harvest the raw garlic, and the raw garlic that suits best for the black garlic, we print to the specialized machine that it uses only the hot air and controlling the humidity inside the machine. And what we do is we put inside the machine for 30 days, and we control the temperature inside the machine for about 30 days to slowly fermentize the garlic naturally. So what happens to the raw garlic is that during the heating process, the garlic becomes yellowish and brownish and black. And during those process, the garlic, the taste, the bitter taste, it has already become sweet taste. At the same time, the raw garlic, the smells, it minimizes most. I wouldn't say it doesn't smell at all, but you hardly smell the garlic from when you fermentize, after you fermentize it.
Now, Scott, black garlic is a traditional. You said it's even a lucky charm. So people have been making this probably for centuries.
Well, it's kind of thing that I hear from a lot of people, but I actually these days I found some other company who makes black garlic. But back then, when I was first making this mass production black garlic, I just heard the idea from people saying about black garlic is a lucky charm kind of thing, and from a lot of ancient history, people were consuming it, but I actually didn't have a chance to eat a black garlic.
Now, where did you get the idea? This is not exactly mainstream thinking, I wouldn't expect, but yes. Correct me there.
First, I actually got into the garlic business around 2004, and then I had some idea about doing some garlic business in Korea. So I went to Korea for met with a lot of the garlic farmers in Korea to do some garlic business. And I happened to meet this guy from UC Davis. He's the garlic professor from Korea, and he works at UC Davis right now. And he was telling me about a lot of the fermenting product around Asia has been good for the body. And we started, since he was focusing on the garlic, he was telling me a lot of the benefit about the fermentizing the garlic. One of the examples, to give a simple example, is that, like, ginseng.
Uh-huh.
This is one of the fermentizing products that, people found that it has a lot of the health benefits. Yeah, I spoke with this garlic professor about fermentizing garlic, and then we end up by, finding out a lot of the health benefits, and it just turns out to be a great product, and that's how I actually got to start.
It's absolutely startling. And when you see it, I mean, we should explain that it is not a clove. It's the whole head of garlic, and it has its skin on the outside, and when you break through the skin, then it is jet black there.
Yeah.
It's like a little gemstone, like some onyx.
Right.
And chefs are going nuts about it. Why are they going nuts about it?
One thing is that, there are people out there who love garlic, but they don't want to consume because of two main problems with the raw garlic. First is that when you eat a raw garlic, it hurts your stomach because it's so strong. Second reason is that when you eat raw garlic, it smells really bad, so people can do their thing during the day if they eat it during any time of their time. So what we did is when you fermentize the garlic, you get rid of those two disadvantages of the garlic. First of all, we minimize all the smell, so which means you hardly smell the garlic. And second of all, the health benefit both actually increases. So what I mean by increasing the benefit of health is that antioxidant becomes the one for our garlic is that it actually goes nearly twice, more than twice, but then I just say twice for our black garlic. And then when you eat it, fermentized garlic, it doesn't hurt your stomach. So people out there who love garlic would be matching with trying out new different type of garlic, and also the people who doesn't have a good chance to eat garlic, they can have black garlic to be another garlic substance for their product.
Well, now you've got this product positively sweeping the country in the hands of chefs, but what about availability for general distribution? How can people find where they can get your product?
Yes, right now I just finished working with Whole Food Market, so it's going to be all around the nationwide.
Oh, Whole Foods.
I saw it there the other day. I saw it in Giant Eagle, too.
Oh, really? Oh, that's wonderful.
Right, yeah.
Now, we should mention that it's the texture is different. It's soft when it's fermented, and it becomes very sweet.
Exactly.
Right. Now, you suggest ways of using it, and I've experimented with it. I've steamed cauliflower with it. I've used it with the tomatoes and the chicken dish. What are some other ideas?
Well, there's a lot of the recipe on our website, but then just a couple of things that I want to mention. A lot of people, that's one of the chefs use it with mashed potato with black garlic. Any food that wants to bring out some of a sweet taste, at the same time, they want to give some kind of good health flavor, it matches really well with our black garlic. So one of the mashed potato with the black garlic has been going really well around people. And a lot of the females, they like the baked bananas with the black garlic.
Banana with, oh, that's wonderful.
Black garlic. and it goes excellent with the salad. And the one another product that I'm making right now is that extract of a black garlic. So what the people can do is that a lot of people in the United States, they eat a lot of, and they can use as a sauce, put on the top of steak, and they can mix around and eat it with it.
That's a great idea. Now, how about giving everybody your website?
Yeah, on our website, we have 11 recipes that I got it from the one of the chefs from the Europe.
And it's www.blackgarlic.com.
How much easier can it be than that?
It's wonderful.
Listeners, the answer is check out the recipes on the website, especially if you like mashed potatoes. It sounds like it's just up your alley. But I'm sure you can think of all kinds of creative ways of doing it. And Scott's in Korea right now making sure that the supply for the future is secure by bringing in another production facility. So, Scott, we thank you so much for taking the time to talk to us. And now I don't know whether you're going to get up or you're going to go back to bed because it's 3:30 in the morning.
All right.
So I guess you get a choice.
Well, you're a trooper for calling at this hour. Thanks so much, Scott, and keep us posted.
Thank you very much for your time. I really appreciate it.
Yeah, are you going to be at the Fancy Food Show?
Yes, it's starting on June 25th. I'm going out to New York for the show.
Well, we'll be there, and we will visit you.
Great. I would love to see you guys. If you ever want some more black curry, I'm more than happy to send you guys.
Oh, that's great. I'm addicted to it, I'm afraid. I just eat it like popcorn. Anyhow, so
it's
we'll
really
see you.
It's really good for health, so
it's good.
I definitely recommend it.
Well, anyhow, I'll see you in New York, and I'll talk to you then. Chef Michael McSweeney is talking to us on the line from Hawaii, and we're talking primarily about his special new salt, but we also want to talk to him a little bit about how he got there, what the food scene's like, and so forth. Let's start with, what is this product, this salt?
Well, aloha, and
aloha.
Great to be with you. I've actually listened to several of your shows since I received your original email, and I really do enjoy your show. It's a lot of fun.
Thank you.
Yeah, the salt. Basically, it's Hawaiian sea salt that's all hand-harvested and solar-dried. Beautiful stuff. And I smoke it over guava wood, which is we have an abundance of guava out here, and it makes a very nice soft smoke, similar to an apple or a cherry wood. And it's just a delicious seasoning.
And it's subtle, and that's the thing that
very
I like
subtle.
About it, it's subtle. And I also asked you, why salt? I mean, you have so much competition out there. I mean, I've had all kinds of Hawaiian salts. Now, why would you pick a product that had such competition?
Well, it's interesting. I mean, the way I really started getting interested in it, I've been in the kitchen all my life, and I've been a chef most of my adult life, and I always loved the sea salt, of course, and I've been using it for years and years and collected some interesting salts over the years. I was in Boston, where my in-laws live, and we go every summer to visit. And my father-in-law sent me to the store for steaks one night, since I usually do all the cooking when we're there.
Read your sign, Michael.
Yeah, okay, thank you. My sign says loud, talk loud. So I went to the Whole Foods, and I picked up some beautiful steaks, and I had some extra money, so I was perusing the spices. And I stumbled across a beautiful French Chardonnay smoked fleur de sel. I think it cost me $21 for a 5.5-ounce jar. Well, it cost my father-in-law. So I picked it up, and I tell you, I just fell in love with it. You know, I'd never really used smoked salt before, and I thought, wow, what a fantastic, you know, product. It's very subtle, very soft. We used it on the steaks that night, of course, and I just kept sprinkling it sparingly because I brought it home with us in the suitcase, And I thought, my goodness, you know, I live in the middle of the Pacific Ocean and surrounded by lots of interesting trees, and we smoke a lot of meats out here, too. So I thought, well, you know, maybe I could make a batch of it and see how it turns out. And it was really never my intention to make it commercially. I just thought, well, I'll play with it a little bit and see if I can make a salt that's as good as this. In the meantime, I was collecting all kinds of smoked salts from around the world, and some good, some not so good, and I kind of found out what I liked, and it took about, 8 or 9 months to really figure it out. It was really kind of a trial and error process, and I used all kinds of different types of wood and tried different salts. And I kept going back to that one jar. I just had a few crumbs left in it, but I'd open it up and I'd smell it and I'd taste it and use that as my benchmark. And there was one day, it was just a eureka day where everything came together. And I pulled the salt off the smokers, and I went upstairs and smelled the other one and figured it out. So then I started making it and giving it to friends, and everybody just loved it. So I thought, well, what the heck? Let's package it up and see if we can sell it. And that's where we are.
Now, this is so far a one-product company?
One-product company. And there's the reason for that is, and I thought originally, if I'm going to start a business, that I should probably have a couple different products. But there's a lot of stuff out there. There's a lot of people that are making blends, and for me, the love that goes into making that smoked salt really shows in the end result. And I thought, you know what, I'm just going to concentrate on this. It's pretty time-consuming, and it's very labor-intensive.
So you actually produce it yourself?
I do. Yes, I don't produce the salt. I've experimented with that, and that's another business down the road. That's a tough one. The people that produce the salt that I use, they just pull up ocean water, very deep ocean water, filter it a couple different ways, and then dry it in the sun. So it takes a lot of space.
Oh, it does, yeah.
We live in kind of a rainy part of the state. And, you know, when it's raining and cloudy,
it doesn't work.
It's not exactly going the right way, is it? It's
not exactly what we...
It's absorbent.
It's the opposite of what I needed to do. So yeah. I buy the salt from people that produce it. There's actually quite a number of people that do make salt. Unfortunately, on our island, there is one salt-producing area. It's called aptly Salt Pond, and it's a very ancient Hawaiian site. And they produce some really fine salt. Unfortunately, it's not. It's kapu to sell, which means it's just you can only give it away or trade it.
Oh dear,
and it's such a great product. A friend of mine had one of the salt beds, and so he provided me with most of the salt that I used when I was experimenting. But I couldn't sell any of it, of course,
because of like religious taboos and things.
Yeah, it's a cultural taboo. Basically, salt is meant to be shared and given. So, unfortunately, for me, I can't just give it all away. So
I guess not.
I have to buy my salt from people who produce it in a different manner and still really wonderful results.
But, well, 10 years ago, you probably...
down there.
Maybe more than that, because it's come a long ways. But, say, 20 years ago, you wouldn't have a market in Hawaii because nobody cared much about the food, huh? But everything's changing.
It certainly has changed a great deal. We've been here, almost 20 years, and yeah, it absolutely has changed. And, you know, the whole food scene has. I think Hawaii was a little late to catch up, as we are with a lot of things, because we are so far away from the rest of the world. But we've definitely caught up, and there's some really great food being produced here. Of course, we've got such an abundance of really nice fish and produce and fruit. So some chefs out there with the vision and the ability to make that happen. And the food scene in Hawaii has kind of, as you said, has changed 100% in the last 20 years.
Yeah, we just saw Roy Yamaguchi. And who else was there?
Alan Wong.
Oh, that's right, Alan Wong.
They were both cooking in Cleveland.
That's a
special event that we were at last Saturday.
Yeah, and of course we've had Peter Merriman on the show. And you said he's opening a restaurant there?
Yeah, he is. He's going to open two restaurants, actually, I think at the end of the summer, which means in the real world, probably sometime in the early winter, because it never really happens the way it should. But yeah, he's one of those handful of people that have really... made a change in the cooking on the island. So it's great to have him on Kauai. I can't wait to eat at his restaurant.
Well,
you might even be able to sell him some salt, huh?
There you go. That'd be great.
That's not a bad idea.
Well, listen, your young charges, the 4 and 6-year-old who are right next door, they've been very well behaved, but I bet they're wondering what the hell Daddy's been doing.
I've been prepping them all week and telling them that if they're good, they can get some special treats if they're quiet. So far, so good. I think they're going to earn that.
I think they deserve it.
Yeah, Daddy, I think it's time for you to deliver treats. Thank you so much for joining us on the menu, Michael.
Thank you so much.
Yeah, Michael, you probably get an email from us. Hello?
Yes.
I said, we'll probably email you when we decide to come to Hawaii, and you can tell us where we ought to go.
Oh, that would be, hey, if you ever get out here, let me know.
Okay.
And I'll have you up to the house for some barbecue.
And a lot of salt.
Lots of salt.
Okay.
Well,
thanks,
you so
Michael.
Much. It was a delight, Ann.
Yeah, and you too.
We'll talk to you again.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Okay, bye.
And now it's time to take another pause for the cause. We'll be right back.
Podcasting services for On the Menu Radio are provided by ASP Station, www.aspstation.net.
Well, here we are again, and we're going to have two sweet products. The first one is Askenosi Chocolate, which is yums. The second is Sweet Heat, which is yums again, double yums maybe in our book.
And both of them have very interesting stories associated
right.
with them. They're certainly second careers for both of them. I mean, when I tell you that the founder of Askenosi Chocolate was a nationally famous criminal defense lawyer, you'll get an idea that there's a sort of an interesting story here. And then the Sweet Heat lady from Northern California is just really sweet, but found a way of putting sweet and savory together that's really quite unique.
Well, On the Menu interviews a lot of chocolate makers, but a few of them end up standing out, as does this chocolate produced by Sean at Askenosi, and his name is Sean Askenosi. Welcome to On the Menu, Sean.
Thank you. Appreciate you having me.
Yeah, well, I mean, we've been enjoying your chocolate. I asked you previously to think about what really differentiates your chocolate from all the other chocolates.
Well, there are about 6 or 7 chocolate makers in the United States that start from the bean and go all the way from that state to the bar. I would say maybe 30 in the world that are small batch makers. And there are really several things that differentiate us from the others around the world. Number one, I think, is our relationship with our farmers.
Yes, we were interested in that. Yeah.
I'm sorry?
We were very interested in that. You have pictures of your farmers on the chocolate
bars. Try to honor the farmer, and that's why the picture of the farmers are on the front of our chocolate bars. These are real people. These are not stock photos from the internet someplace. And we have a relationship with them, and this is something that was important to me from the very beginning. It's one of the reasons we don't use vanilla in our chocolate. We want to try to keep the chocolate as pure as we can. There's only 2 ingredients in it, and that's beans and organic sugar. And, again, honoring the farmer. So I think that's a difference, the way we treat them, the fact that our chocolate's 100% traceable to each farmer, the fact that we profit share with the farmers, that's also different. I'm not saying that others don't have programs to help, but this is just, I think, a point of difference where we treat the farmers in that way financially. The other thing that I think is different about us is the chocolate that we make. We make white chocolate. We're the only small-batch chocolate makers in North America that makes white chocolate.
But that's not really chocolate, is it?
It is chocolate. It's very much chocolate. He says it's chocolate, and I can tell you it's chocolate because when we stand at our cocoa butter press, turning liquor into cocoa butter, that is cocoa mass, that is from the bean.
Well, what's the difference? I mean, how do you get
Well, the difference is that it doesn't have, we've taken the cocoa butter out of the bean. And the cocoa, you know, cocoa butter occupies about 45 to 50% of the cocoa bean. And so there's quite a bit of cocoa butter in the bean, and we extract that using a cocoa butter press. And then once we take it out of the bean, then we put it into a melangeur, about a 100-year-old mill from Germany, and we mix that together with a dairy. And in our case, we use goat's milk powder and then organic sugar. And after several days, it takes us about 2 weeks to go to make a batch of white chocolate. But it's very much chocolate.
I better taste that then.
No,
I avoided
really
it
good.
Altogether.
I ate it all already.
Oh, did you?
It's good stuff. And you know,
see, I've never liked white chocolate, so I never even got near it.
I didn't either. Until I started making it.
So now
but
I didn't have any.
it's been a lot of fun, and we've really been surprised by the response. And there's a lot of people around the world who really enjoy white chocolate, and so we're connecting with those people. So that's one thing. Another thing is, because we make the white chocolate, when you press all of the cocoa butter out, and you squeeze as much cocoa butter out as you can, something is left over called press cake. And we take that press cake and we mill it into natural cocoa powder. And we're the only people in North America making natural cocoa powder from scratch in small batches. And we ship that stuff all over the world to professional bakers and home bakers. It's got a punch. It's got some acidity to it because we don't do anything to Dutch process or alkali this cocoa powder, removing the acidity. So it's a nice, it's a great thing to make chocolate cake with.
Now, how did you get started doing this? You don't wake up one day and say, I'm going to be a better than fair trade cocoa maker, coffee maker, chocolate maker. What am I talking about? I'm getting confused here. So were you doing something similar already, Sean, and then you just said, this is a better idea?
Peter, I was a criminal defense lawyer for about 20 years.
Oh, my God.
I specialized in felony cases, in particular murder cases and white-collar crime cases. And I loved that for a long time, and I felt like I was in the right place at the right time doing what I needed to do. And during my career, I was always interested in social justice issues, always. I mean, since before college. But there came a time when I needed to do something different. There came a time when I needed to change careers. I just didn't know what it was going to be. I didn't know. And I had a hobby of grilling, and then that hobby turned into baking, and then from baking into making chocolate desserts. And all the while, I needed another inspiration. I didn't know what it was going to be. So I literally committed finding a new passion, prayer, for about 5 years. And in May of 2005, this idea came to me to make chocolate scratch, and I really didn't know what that meant at that time. And within a few months of that, I was in the Amazon studying how farmers can influence the final taste of chocolate by how they treat these beans post-harvest.
You're unreal, absolutely unreal. It's amazing.
And do you miss playing Johnny Cochran?
No, I loved it. And I've been on Court TV a number of times, and there were two Dateline specials made from murder cases that I tried and won. And it just, there were death threats, there were those kind of things that obviously can weigh on you and stress, and uh-huh, stress your family. And I don't miss it. I don't miss the courtroom. I knew that I'd be making a big change, and honestly, the money was great, and I could use some of that money now to buy equipment.
I can imagine.
But we're having a great time doing this, and thankfully my family has been very supportive. My wife works here. My daughter, who's in college.
And where are you located?
We're in Springfield, Missouri, so right in the center of the country.
Oh, my goodness. Well, that's a really unlikely place to be.
It is, although I grew up here, and this is where I practiced law, and we have our factory in a 100-year-old building in a part of town that's undergoing renovation. And we're very, very engaged in the neighborhood around our factory with the children in a program that we started called Chocolate University. And there's a homeless shelter a block from our factory, and most of those kids that are at that shelter go to a nearby school, and we are definitely engaged in their lives.
Now, tell us, you told us before we came on the air about special beans that you're getting from Mexico and special beans that you're getting from the Philippines. Tell our listeners about that.
My wife says that I do everything the hardest way possible. So if there's a challenging way to do it, then that's the path I'm going to pick, and just pick the most difficult one, and that's me. So I wanted these beans from Soconusco, Mexico, because I'd read about them. I knew they were historic. Montezuma literally took over that part of Mexico just for the beans. They killed for these beans. But after the Spanish conquest, these beans were, the crops died, the farmers died, and ultimately they were no longer available in Europe. But I'd read about them, and there was an anthropologist in Southern California who introduced me to these farmers. I traveled there numerous times, and finally we were able to get these beans out. And she says that we're the first chocolate makers in the world to make chocolate from these beans outside of Mexico in over 100 years. And this is the 75% bar that we have, and it's cherish those beans, and we appreciate our relationship with that part of the world, and we've had a lot of fun with the chocolate. The Philippines is also historic because it's the first place the Spanish brought cacao to grow in Asia in 1600. First they brought it to Africa and then to Asia in 1600, and so I knew of the history there, and it took me 2 years, literally from the moment I started trying to find farmers to actually traveling to the Philippines and then releasing the chocolate, 2 years to the month.
Jeez.
And we're really proud of that because they had not exported beans. That country had not exported a cocoa bean to a chocolate maker in 30 years since their land reform, and now we're making a single origin from the Philippines.
Now, you have another story like that?
Another one?
Yes.
We have another origin, but thankfully Ecuador, which is a very mature cocoa market in the world, they are a great country to do business with, and their cocoa beans are famous, and so we didn't have as much trouble there. Now, I went to Venezuela, and I spent a lot of time and money in Venezuela, and I learned a lot because the farmers there actually stole close to $30,000 from me.
Oh, shit.
Okay, we don't have an origin from Venezuela.
So you learned the wrong thing.
Well, you would think a lawyer would know better than to wire all that money without getting it. But, you know, I trusted them, and I trusted the people I'd been down there to meet, and I had to learn the hard way how, that's the price that's the risk that we take to have these direct relationships with farmers, because the easier thing to do would be to call a commodities broker, place an order, and get the beans. But I want to know the story. I want to make sure they're not using pesticides and chemicals. I want to make sure that they're using environmentally friendly farming practices. And the only way that I know to do that is to have these direct relationships.
Now, that must make your chocolate fairly expensive.
You know, expensive is relative, and that's a great question. Here's my question back, and you guys are going to know this. What else in the world can you buy the best of, and I'm not saying ours is the best, but we compete with the best. What else can you buy the best of for $8? You can't buy the best olive oil for $8. You're not going to buy the best wine, the best champagne, just the best cheese. You're not going to buy the best bread. It's so expensive is relative, and I think it's a great, great value for people to spend $8, $10 on a chocolate bar when you consider what they get when you're buying it from a small-batch bean-to-bar chocolate maker in the world, whether it's here or Europe, because there's a lot that goes into it, and there's a lot of benefit, I think, that people get from it, especially if they're using environmentally friendly practices and if they're engaging the farmers. I think those are very important things, and people recognize the value.
So it's a whole lot better than Godiva.
No comment. I learned that a long time ago, and there are some companies out there that are great, that are large companies. Mars, for example. Mars is doing great work around the world trying to help farmers, and I think a lot of people don't even know the kind of work that Mars
does. I don't know.
I've seen it myself firsthand in the Philippines.
Well, they're a very secretive company because they're still family-owned after all this time, right?
They are, although I think that now they're beginning to really understand the importance of sustainable agriculture, and not just understand it, but I mean communicate it to their customers, and they're doing that, and I'm familiar with some of the senior people there, and I've really been heartened by the way that the things that I've learned about the way they're treating people.
And on the other end of it, I mean, everybody's angry, anybody in the know is angry with Hershey that's it's moved all of its manufacturing to Mexico.
It's a problem, and it's not good. And not only have they done that, but they've closed down the Scharfenberger plant, which was at least in the United States.
They didn't close it, did they?
Oh my God!
Yeah, they closed it.
I knew they bought it, but I didn't know.
Well,
they
bought it, and then they closed it and consolidated it with other manufacturers.
Oh, that poor man!
No,
he just took
the money.
He said, took the money.
We talked to somebody who knew him, and he said to his friend, was it Ricciuti? He said, they kept on offering me more money, and when it got to $75 million, I couldn't say no.
I'm not sure that it was 75, but John Scharfenberger,
he's
on to a new venture now, and unfortunately his partner, Dr. Steinberg, he died, succumbed to a cancer that he'd had for a long time, too long ago.
So what's the new venture with that?
I think that, well, Scharfenberger is involved in a lot of different things, but the most recent thing that I think he's involved with is making aged ham, forgot the name for it, but I read about it recently. And so he's, and before this he was involved, I guess, winemaking or sparkling wine. And so I'm sure he'll always have his hand in the food world in some way, but I don't know what the exact price was. But the point being, Hershey closed it down, and I think a lot of people were disappointed. And, because Scharfenberger really was the inspiration for all of us here in the U.S. that have started this small-batch chocolate making.
Well, now before we sign off, let's make sure listeners know how they can get more information and where they can buy your wonderful chocolate.
They can get more information by first going to our website, which is askinosi.com. That's my last name, askinosie.com. Or they can call us at the factory at 417-862-9900. And we sell it online and we ship it around the world. In fact, interestingly, Sweden is our number one customer. We sell more chocolate to a distributor in Sweden than we do to any other place around the world. We sell it to them by the metric ton, and we're a small family business. There's only 5 people working here.
Okay.
Then we started selling in Australia. We sell to about 50 stores in Australia, and then Singapore, and now
the UK. Do you sell to Hague's in Australia?
I don't know that we do because we have a distributor. I'm not certain about
it's
that.
It's a big candy chain called Hague. I wish we were related, but we're not.
They're a chocolate maker. We went into their shop and we said we must be related, and it turns out,
I want my family discount.
It turned out that wasn't true.
and then we sell it in the UK at Selfridge's department store.
Selfridge's, and we're
constantly looking at other countries, and then we sell to specialty food stores around the country. And
yeah, are you at Mon Ami Chocolates in Pittsburgh?
Yes,
I'm sure
we are.
She's very, very smart about her chocolates.
I think we are, and we're sell at little places here in my town, and then Kansas City and St. Louis and New York, San Francisco. And
but anybody listening can get it online, which is a good thing.
Yeah.
Now, do you actually have a store locator as well?
We don't have a store locator online, but people just email us and say, "Do you have it in my town?" And we can tell them pretty quickly. And we have the thing we do now is we do a lot of really great shipping things, especially for summer. If people spend over $40, depending on their location, to our factory, it's free, or $50, it's free. And because we have to be really careful in the summer. But you know, people ask, "Do you ship chocolate in the summer because it's hot?" Absolutely, we ship it all through the summer. We're just really careful about how we pack it and how we ship it.
Right.
Well, this is a wonderful story. I can't wait to find out what you do after you've made chocolate. Maybe you'll run for president.
I don't think so. My wife said this is the last new business. No more. It's our 22nd anniversary this weekend, and she said no more. Chocolate's the last one.
She sounds like a saint.
She is. Her title here at the factory is Director of Common Sense.
Oh, my God. That's wonderful.
Everybody needs one.
And what's your title, Sean?
I don't even really have just founder. They don't tell you
your title to your face, I guess.
Exactly.
Well, thank you again, and it's really been a pleasure. You're at the Fancy Food Show?
Yes, we'll be there. In fact, we were really excited. We just were notified that we won the Sophie Silver Award in the chocolate category. There's only 5 in the U.S., and
that's how we found you.
Yeah, we'll be really excited about it.
Well, I'm going to have to come by and taste the white chocolate.
Yeah, and we'll be cheering for you, hoping you get a gold.
Well, I hope. Are you going to be there?
We shall be.
Oh, well, please stop by and say hello.
We absolutely will.
Thanks, Sean.
Thank you very much for having me. I really appreciate it.
Great talking to you. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
I think it was Aristotle who said Eureka for the first time after having discovered Archimedes' principle. And the story is that he ran through the streets of
Syracuse.
I thought it was Alexandria without his clothes on.
It was Syracuse.
But the next product we're going to talk about has a double Eureka. First of all, our guest, Diane
Hunt,
is talking to us from near Eureka in Northern California. But more importantly, if you open a jar of her product and you don't know what it is, Eureka might be one of the words that would pop out of your mouth. Diane, would you like to explain?
Yes.
Your company is Sweet Heat.
Yeah, it's Diane Sweet Heat, and I'm located in Humboldt County, which is in Northern California.
No, but haven't you ever had anybody say Eureka after they first took a spoonful?
Oh, yes.
That's what I meant. My humor was obviously far too obscure.
I thought you wanted me to explain where Eureka is, and yes, Eureka, it's a lovely taste. It just takes you away when you take a bite of my jam.
Why don't you tell us the story about how you started making this jam?
Well, my best friend and I, over 20 years ago, when we wanted to make a Christmas gift for our friends, didn't have a lot of money, so we decided to make jalapeno jelly, which we thought was very different and interesting, and decided to make that as our gift. Our friends loved it, and that started a holiday tradition. So each holiday, then, we would change the recipe up a bit, maybe change peppers out, and we did that for several years, and then decided to try to add some fruits. Then added all kinds of fruits to our jams, and our friends and family loved it. As thank you to our guests at my daughter's wedding a few years ago, we made 500 jars of it and gave it away, and friends and family said, oh, you two really need to market this. And my friend said, I'm not interested. And I thought, shoot, why not? So that's what started it.
I'll be darned. So, I mean, where are you in the development of this as a company now?
I'm still really small. I rent a kitchen, and I make very small batches of about 2.5 4-ounce cases per batch. So I only get about 62 jars. I'm selling it locally to the grocery stores and online, and I've done a few festivals just trying to get my name out there, and emailing people like the Nimble magazine and asking them if they would be willing to try my product, where I believe that's where you heard about me.
Probably, yeah.
Now, try and describe the taste sensation associated with this, Diane, because it's really quite unusual.
Just, I feel like it's, you take a bite and it's robust with fruit, and I have 6 fruit flavors, blackberry, blueberry, mango, peach, raspberry, and strawberry, and you think, oh, this is just a jam, but then shortly thereafter comes this nice heat of the habanero, and I just love the flavor of the habanero pepper.
Yeah, it's, I mean, this is a wonderful, wonderful what change, but it's very, I think, unique as a condiment.
Yeah, Anne has explained in the past that she went to a pepper tasting once with
Diane Bayless.
Yeah, Diane Bayless from the Mexican restaurant group in Chicago. Diane set them the test that they could describe the taste of peppers. The only word they were not allowed to use is anything that had to do with heat. because it turns out that if you step aside from the fact that there is certainly some pepperiness, some heat in the pepper, there's also a unique flavor. And I think that must be the thing that comes out in your product, don't you think?
Yes. I can't even explain it. I just think it's just, I love the flavor of it. It settles so well, and the flavor of the pepper dissipates quickly, too. It's not like you're taking a bite of a pepper and you've got that heat and you just don't know how to get rid of it. This, I think, is the sweetness and the heat that it just melts in your mouth.
Now, how do you see being used? Is it a breakfast spread on a bagel or toast, or what? When might otherwise one turn to a jar of sweet heat?
What's really easy and what we do most is just pour it over like a block of cream cheese or goat cheese and serve it with crackers.
Oh, I see.
So it's a wonderful appetizer.
Okay.
And that's when we gave them as gifts. And when I do give them as gifts, I usually give them the goat cheese or the cream cheese and the crackers to give the whole appetizer.
Oh, maybe we should do that tonight then.
Yeah, we could do that. Except we have goat cheese, but it's flavored goat cheese already, so we might have to be careful. We're going to a neighbor's house tonight, and curiously enough, we just got some goat spreadable goat cheese.
Oh. If it's flavored, I don't think that I would use it.
No, I think both
the, I don't know.
I think all the different supplies we got were flavored. But the idea of a plain goat cheese or a block of cream cheese, that sounds like a great idea.
Oh, it's really good. And use a fairly plain cracker when I give sampling. And when I give gifts, I will do like a wheat thin or a car water cracker, something very
right.
Subtle.
Okay, so for breakfast, it's more for the Australian who likes Vegemite and marmalade at the same time, something a little more severe than most American palates would take for breakfast.
I don't know. We do it frequently. That's kind of how we started using the
Okay, so that's
jam,
another way of doing it as well.
Yeah, but we do. I use it in all kinds of things. And students, as I give a lot to our students and people I talk with, they love it on bagels with a peanut butter as a peanut butter and jelly sandwich.
Oh, that would be good, too.
Yeah.
Would you leave out the peanut butter or the jelly?
Yeah, put my jam and place in the jelly, and it's really good. It's just got that little bite to it.
Yeah.
You know, it's kind of a special sandwich because I don't think you'd want to do that every day. But
yeah, well, it's you know, I told you how I eat it. I use a spoon and eat it right out of the jar.
Now, what's the website, Dan, that people can get it at? Go ahead and spell it all out because there's an E in the middle there somewhere.
Yes, it's dianessweetheat.com, and that is dianessweetheat.com,
right.
So if you're looking for something different for breakfast or something different as an appetizer, here's a new idea. And, of course, as always, you heard about it on the menu first, or almost first. Diane, we hope you have a wonderful day in Eureka. I understand it's wild and windy and rainy there, and it's about to get that way here, so we'll be in this together, but that's fine because we can restore our inner warmth anytime we want to.
That's right. I'm taking off today, heading inland to get 80-degree weather.
Okay. Good for you. Okay, say hello to Mary Keene for us.
I will. When did you interview her?
Oh, we've done it a number of times.
Well, as we usually do, we find ourselves ready to wrap this program. It goes very quickly.
And we'll see you again, same time, same place next week.
Bye-bye.